This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, January 7th, 2002. Pimping for the Imperium. Pimping for the Imperium. The headline, the cover story of the New York Times Magazine this Sunday, January 5th. The American Empire, Get Used to It, by Michael Ignatieff, who's the executive director of the Carr Center of Human Rights Policy, which is part of the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. American Empire, Get Used to It, says Michael Ignatieff. And then the cover story of U.S. News World and Report this week, their January 13th issue, The New American Empire. Americans have an enduring aversion to planting the flag on foreign soil, says new U.S. News and World Report. Is that attitude changing? In an article by Jay Tolson. Pimping for the Imperium. Ralph, explain what we mean by pimping for the Imperium.
Well, Maya, people like Michael Ignatieff, who is, as you say, the director of the Carr Professor of Human Rights Practice, director of the Carr Center of Human Rights, whose essays include four primary themes: the moral connection created by modern culture with distant victims of war, the impact of ethnic war, another called the Needs of Strangers, an essay on the philosophy of human needs, another, The Warrior's Honor, Ethnic War and the Modern Conscience. The epitome of the liberal professor and academic purporting to be concerned with human rights under the cover of, as many of the NGOs and so-called civil society groups are. They're funded privately. They are answerable to nobody. They indulge in the rhetoric of liberal facade and human rights, blah, blah. And when it comes down to it, they create the rationale and the cover for imperialism and for its devastation. What's interesting about this, Maya, is that for so long, any attempt to discuss the imperial nature of capitalism, its predatory character, the dynamic of U.S. power and its structure of power and its drive for profits and its imposition of repressive regimes, its perpetual destruction, every movement for social change, for national independence, for human rights, for national sovereignty itself. Every attempt on the part of anti-imperialists to describe this reality has been scoffed at by the liberals and by the guardians of the established order. Now they are proclaiming it and creating an open and overt rationale for its legitimacy and its perpetuation. Pimping for the Imperium is exactly what it is. Michael Ignatieff, in this major piece in the New York Times, not only talks about the necessity for it, he says get used to it is the subtitle, but it's called The Burden. The Burden. The white man's burden is now the moral burden of the United States to assume the Christ-like responsibility for the problems of the world.
And in it, he also creates a fictional history of the United States. Let's look at how Michael Ignatieff opens his article, The Burden. He states, it is, speaking of the United States, or as he says, America, quote, it is the only nation that polices the world through five global military commands, maintains more than 1 million men and women at arms on four continents, deploys carrier battle groups on watch in every ocean, guarantees the survival of countries from Israel to South Korea, drives the wheels of global trade and commerce. And he says that in enforcing such an order as there is in the world, and doing so in the American interest, it means laying down the rules America wants on everything from markets to weapons of mass destruction, while exempting itself from other rules, such as the Kyoto Protocol on climate change or the International Criminal Court, that U.S. rulers consider go against its interests.
Actually, Maya, he expands on this, and after all, it's an article of some 15 pages in the New York Times Magazine section, elaborate rationale for empire. He states that that September 11th was an awakening, a moment of reckoning with the extent of American power and the avenging hatreds it arouses. Americans may not have thought of the World Trade Center or the Pentagon as a symbolic headquarters of a world empire, but the men with the box cutters certainly did. It means enforcing such order as there is in the world and doing so in the American interest, he states. But he claims, America's empire is not like empires of times past built on colonies, conquest, and the white man's burden. We are no longer in the era of the United Fruit Company when American corporations needed the Marines to secure their investments overseas. The 21st century imperium is a new invention in the annals of political science, an empire light, a global hegemony whose grace notes are free markets, human rights, and democracy, enforced by the most awesome military power the world has ever known. It is the imperialism of a people who remember that their country secured its independence by revolt against an empire. It is an empire without consciousness of itself, its good intentions arousing resentment, but that does not make it any less of an empire, with a conviction that it alone bears the arc of the liberties of the world.
Well, I don't know what world he's been living in. The U.S. Marines went into Nicaragua, sent there by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. U.S. troops went into Grenada. U.S. troops were in Panama. U.S. troops were sent to Haiti. U.S. troops throughout Africa, for instance, in Somalia. U.S. troops in ex-Yugoslavia. U.S. troops in Afghanistan. U.S. troops before, in 91, in Iraq. U.S. troops at the moment as advisors in Colombia and the Philippines. You name the place across the world and you will find U.S. troops.
Well, every major spokesperson for capital of every nominal political party in the United States since the War of 1812 and 1814 has expounded the necessity for expansion of U.S. capital. And they are explicit in these regards. The Western movement had reached the Pacific, but this did not satisfy U.S. expansionism. Distinguished historian Lelio Basso has described with regard to Latin America. Richard Olney, the Secretary of State under Grover Cleveland, would declare, "Now we are sovereign on this continent, and our will is law wherever we choose to intervene." And Frederick Jackson Turner, the historian of American expansionism, stated, "The needs of the United States are now a foreign policy of dominion, an interoceanic canal, the awakening of our naval power, and the extension of our domination to encompass faraway islands as well as countries closer to us to show clearly we are on the move and that we shall continue to expand. We must have the Chinese market or we shall have a revolution," stated Senator Frye at the same time. And Brooks Adams concluded that U.S. economy will stagnate if the United States does not consolidate its control over Latin America and, quote, "render the Far East an economic colony." Even 50 years prior to that, the grandfather of Brooks Adams, Quincy Adams, using the Christian principles provide a rationale for the imperial expansion of American capital. "The moral obligation upon which commercial relations are based is exclusively and entirely the Christian proverb, 'Love thy neighbor as thyself.' But the Chinese are not Christian. They do not consider that they should love their neighbors as themselves. They have a principle and a system that is hostile and anti-commercial. The principle of the Chinese Empire is opposed to our dominion. It does not believe in having relations with other countries. It is high time that this outrage against human rights and human decency is ceased." And Henry Cabot Lodge, "To retain our commercial supremacy in the Pacific," he said in 1895, "we shall seize control of the Hawaiian Islands and remain on Samoa." and the declaration of war against Spain for Cuba was indeed the occasion for McKinley, President McKinley, to declare, "The Lord has said that the United States has the duty of educating and elevating the Philippines into Christian civilization, and by the grace of God to do all that we can for our brother nation for whom Christ also died." And he adds, "The Philippines are ours forever, and right behind them is the immense Chinese market. We shall not leave either one." Such is the leitmotif, the constant theme, of all the spokespersons for capital throughout the course of American history, right into the current century. Woodrow Wilson, who Ignatieff continually invokes as a person who is pursuing the introduction of democracy and just and progressive and honorable sovereignty for nations, quote, "to make the world safe for democracy." Wilson, speaking to manufacturers in 1912, states, "If the United States does not have dominion and free enterprise, it will have no liberty at all. Our industry has developed to the point where it will collapse unless we have control of the world market. Our home market is insufficient. We must dominate foreign trade." By 1924, Herbert Hoover was stating the same thing. "Foreign markets are more important to us to assure stable and normal functioning of our industry. They have an importance greater than the percentage of export in relation to home consumption. And this theme was perpetuated not only by these figures such as Herbert Hoover and Woodrow Wilson, but the president of the National Industrial Conference Board of Franklin Roosevelt, Virgil Jordan, who stated on December 10, 1940, "Whatever the outcome of the war may be, America has taken the road towards imperialism on an economic plane as on all other planes of life. Some fear this word imperialism so menacing and well known. Most people prefer in the American way to mask the fact under a more vague expression such as defense of the Western Hemisphere. But we are destined by our temperament, by our capacity, by our resources, by the course of world affairs, not only those of the last few years, but since the last century, destined to follow our road. We have no choice. We shall continue on this road that we have been going along, which began with the annexation of Cuba and the Philippines. This empire sees its possibilities for expansion on the southern part of this hemisphere and west in the Pacific. Exhausted, we will continue further. The planet is our arena. The scepter falls in the hands of the United States." And Franklin Roosevelt's spokesperson was then succeeded by Harry Truman, who stated, "The American system will only survive if it is global and the entire world is made to adopt the American system," by which, of course, he means submission to American capitalism. The imperial rationale is a constant of American history, and the ideologues of its justification are only belatedly acknowledging that reality and presenting it as something forced upon the United States anew.
And now we have Michael Ignatieff, who was in talking about the invasion of Iraq, has to come up with a rationale for why this invasion makes sense. He talks about the United States. He says, "Even now, as President Bush appears to be maneuvering the country toward war with Iraq, the deepest implication of what is happening has not been fully faced. That Iraq is an imperial operation that would commit a reluctant republic, meaning the United States, to become the guarantor of peace, stability, and democratization and oil supplies in a combustible region of Islamic peoples stretching from Egypt to Afghanistan." Now note, he talks about the region as a combustible region without understanding that it is the United States itself that has undermined the struggles for democracy and for worker and peasant control throughout the Middle East. When he refers to the United States and also to Saddam, let's look at how he again talks about Saddam Hussein. He refers to him as an expansionist rights violator who was holding Iraq together with terror. Now, remember, as we've talked about over the past weeks, the intent always has to be to demonize the Saddam Hussein as a rationale for the attack, to talk about his weapons of mass destruction, which were supplied by the United States and European powers. In order to get Saddam Hussein involved in a war against Iraq, Iran, to bleed both Iran and Iraq dry for further control of the oil of the region. And so we have the demonizing of Saddam Hussein, the discussion of the Middle East as a combustible region that is needing the white man's burden, the people of the United States, to create democracy and to create, quote, stability. And by stability, they mean the garnering of profits for U.S. capitalism.
Maya Ignatieff writes, regime change is an imperial task par excellence, and it assumes the empire's interest and a right to trump the sovereignty of a state. He states, what moral authority rests with a sovereign who murders and ethnically cleanses his own people, has twice invaded neighboring countries and usurps his people's wealth in order to build palaces and lethal weapons? The administration is not alone. Not even Kofi Annan, the Secretary General charged with defending the United Nations Charter, claims that sovereignty confers impunity for such crimes, and he has made it clear he would prefer to leave a disarmed Saddam in power rather than risk the conflagration of war to unseat him, but the United States will not leave it at that. Now, what's instructive about this, as you've just been indicating, is that Saddam Hussein is an imposition of the Central Intelligence Agency. And indeed, it goes back to the Arab struggle against empire, the Ottoman Empire. The national aspirations of the Arab peoples were for self-determination, for independence, for national sovereignty. And it was Lawrence Arabia who enlisted the Arab peoples in a struggle against the Ottoman Empire with the promise that the outcome of that would be independence, national sovereignty, and the creation of the of independent nations across the Arab world. And indeed, the opposite in the Sykes-Picot Treaty was effected when the region was carved up between French and British imperialism between them. The whole history, not only of the Middle East, but of course of all of the areas that have been dominated by imperialism, British, French, German, Japanese, Dutch, Belgian, and now American imperialism, has been the struggle for the democratic realization of self-determination for these peoples, for command over their own natural resources, for their control over their own political destinies. And it is that which the Imperium exists to prevent. For in the particular instance of Saddam Hussein, it was the National Revolution of Iraq in 1958, which not only legalized the nationalist parties and the communist parties, but confined control over Iraqi oil on the part of foreign oil companies to 0.1% of the territory of Iraq, that induced the Central Intelligence Agency, as it has across the planet, to overthrow that regime. And it was done through the Central Intelligence Agency's office in Baghdad, and the vehicle was the assassination of Abdul Karim Qasim, and the instrument of that was none other than Saddam Hussein, who then set up the torture chambers that killed and tormented and murdered hundreds of thousands of Arab Iraqi aspirants towards national self-determination. It is the democracy, the sovereignty, the struggle for independence that has been destroyed by imperial intervention, and it is the subjugation of peoples which is its purpose. Nowhere has this been better set forth than in the interesting and revealing study of the Brookings Institution in 1978. A comprehensive study with a detailed analysis of the frequency of U.S. military interventions between 1946 and 1975. Now, what's instructive about this, Maya, is that this study called Force U.S. Armed Forces as a political instrument was prepared for the Defense Department's Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. People have assumed that DARPA is a recent phenomenon. On the contrary, it is since the 1970s that this entire scenario for the breakup of states throughout the region and for the reversal of the anti-colonial revolution has been put on the drawing board. And the DARPA study, the DARPA research project for which the Brookings Institute study was prepared, revealed that there had been U.S. military intervention 215 times between 1946 and 1975 in which, quote, the armed forces were used for specific political objectives, unquote. U.S. armed forces were utilized on an average, the report reveals, 7.2 times a year. Once a month from 1956 to 1965, 7.2 times a year for the 30-year period between 1945 and 1975. That is the antecedent to the preparations for the breakup of the region, and they were indeed prepared for by a Mossad document that we've often discussed, the Oded Yinon report, A Strategy for Israel in the 1980s, which called for the fragmentation of each Middle Eastern country in its turn, with the specific targeting of Iraq as the primary vehicle for the fragmentation of the previous nation states. Each of these countries was considered to be vulnerable to its return to ethnic and religious components that preceded the national revolutions that overthrew or sought to overthrow colonialism in the region. That's the real meaning of the imperium. It is that which these liberal and academic rationalizers seek to justify today.
Also, they justify occupation, not only fragmentation, but occupation, because it is the fragmentation of Yugoslavia that created Bosnia, Kosovo, Serbia, which are now occupied. And people such as Ignatieff refer to occupation in a positive light, as occupation creating democracy in Germany and in Japan. What Ignatieff concludes with is America has inherited a world scarred not just by the failures of empires past, but also by the failure of nationalist movements to create and secure free states. And now suddenly by the desire of Islamicists to build theocratic tyrannies on the ruins of failed nationalist dreams. But what Ignatieff does not note, as Ralph has been talking about, is it is the imperium itself that has destroyed the nationalist movements throughout the world and prevented the rise of the workers' movement and the workers' and peasants' movement for the completion of the anti-colonial struggle, whether it was the overthrow, the direct overthrow in Chile of the Allende government, or in Guatemala of the Arbenz government, or in Iran of the Mossadegh government, or in Iraq of the
Abdul Qasim.
Or in the Congo,
across the planet, as you say. It is indeed imperialism which destroys the aspirations of the populations for control over their destiny.
And in our recent times, through the auspices of the World Bank and the IMF, have created debt for these countries and also destroyed their economies, where countries such as Algeria, which had once been food self-sufficient, becomes an importer of the very food that it requires for the population to survive. Now, when Condoleezza Rice was questioned by U.S. News and World Report, and Condoleezza Rice is the National Security Advisor for the Bush administration, she said, "The United States does not have territorial ambitions or ambitions to control other people." But the response of U.S. News and World Report, which, as we all know, is not a radical Marxist publication, but even for U.S. News and World Report, it's so obvious what is taking place. And Jay Tolson says, Are we witnessing a smart bomb imperium?
It is called, his piece in the January 13th cover story article of U.S. News and World Report, The New American Empire, Americans have an enduring aversion to planting the flag on foreign soil. Is that attitude changing? It was not a move that President William McKinley would look back on with pride. His reluctant 1898 decision to declare war in Spain ended up humbling America's opponent and bringing in new territories from Puerto Rico to the Philippines. For the first time in its history, the United States had joined those world powers intent on planting flags on foreign land. And then he goes on to say the audacity that the Condoleezza Rice has confirmed that the subjugation that occurred in the Gulf War in Kosovo and Afghanistan subdued foes with modest expenditure of treasure and little or no blood. Little or no blood. The reports today from Afghanistan are that there is a tenfold increase in cancer and in systemic disease as a result of the flooding of the country with depleted uranium, the consequence of which are only beginning to be monitored on the scale that they have been detected, reflecting what had occurred previously in Serbia, in Kosovo, Iraq, and, of course, again in Afghanistan.
When on Veterans Day, when President Bush gave a speech, he said, quote, "We have no territorial ambitions. We don't seek an empire." And according to Tolson, scholars object to the word because, as Zelikow, who is a political scientist, has said, in an empire, you control other nations. You write their laws and so on. Write their laws. Look at the occupation plans for Iraq. In today's New York Times, Monday, January 6th, New York Times, the U.S. is completing plan to promote a democratic Iraq, is an article by David Sanger and James Dow. And they report on the occupation plans that are being leaked from the Bush administration, which initially call for a heavy American military presence in the country for at least 18 months, military trials of senior Iraqi leaders, and a, quote, quick takeover of the country's oil fields. Quick takeover of the country's oil fields. Note that. Also, if you look at what took place in Japan and in Germany, it was very much the U.S. involvement in the writing of the country's laws. So much for not having a hand in the administration of the development of a country. Now, with Iraq, the Bush administration is saying there will be both a civilian administrator, that is a fig leaf of administration, to deal with rebuilding schools, political institutions, and the economy, and to administer aid programs. But they acknowledge that the primary power will be with the military commander, and most people think that will be General Tommy Franks. So here we have outlining the occupation, and as I said, the most important aspect of it is seizing the oil fields.
Before we deal with that, Maya, I think it's worthwhile to examine more closely the article by Jay Tolson, The New American Empire, which complements that of Ignatieff in the New York Times, as it does the piece by Fuad Ajami in U.S. News and World Report called "Hail the American Imperium." And Ajami is an instrument of U.S. policy, has always been that in the Arab East, serving the purposes of the intelligence agencies who sponsor these reports. But in the Jay Tolson piece on January 13th in the same publication, he does something rather interesting. He attempts to associate American imperialism with the aspirations of the American Revolution itself. not with the control of the property owners and of concentrated capital that captured the state for the purpose of securing its hegemony first in the American continent and then abroad. But also, he particularly associates the imperial aspiration with Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson. He quotes, he states, "Even such a visionary as Thomas Paine believed America would spread its values only by example. Perhaps the fullest elaboration of the policy implications of this conviction came in John Quincy Adams' 4th of July speech, 'America does not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all.'" Now, what's interesting about this is that Thomas Paine was a revolutionary who stated that the world is my country. Wherever people are hungry, that is my home. Wherever their liberty is taken from them, that is where I belong. Wherever they are oppressed, wherever they are subjugated, that is where my struggle begins. Thomas Paine was an internationalist who, after the American Revolution, returned to England to foment revolution in Great Britain, working class struggle, and then the French Revolution itself. The antithesis of these 18th century revolutionaries were the property owners and the capitalists who seized control of the state. The imperialism that they espoused was that which would have subjugated the American revolutionaries of Thomas Paine's day.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen on WBAI New York 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored radio, and on the internet at www.wbai.org. You can reach us at our WBAI voicemail, 212-209-2953. Our email is takingaim@pacbell.net, and our address is Post Office Box 6345, Vallejo, V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California, 94591. Again, our phone number is 212-209-2953. Our program today, Pimping for the Imperium. Ralph?
MSNBC, Maya, did a rather telling series called Oil After Saddam, All Bets Are In. A great but quiet rush is on for a stake in Iraq's huge reserves. The American campaign to overthrow Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has taken on a particular meaning. Largely missing from the debate, however, is the simple fact that Iraq sits atop the world's second largest reserves of oil, a resource that translates into hundreds of billions, indeed trillions of dollars, and enormous economic power. And then it states that within America, street protests accusing the administration of yearning to launch an oil war occur occasionally. But they pale in comparison to the vehemence of that charge in foreign capitals and newspapers, in European and Asian capitals, in the rest of the Muslim world, and in particular, an imperialistic quest for oil is taken as the ultimate goal of American policy in Iraq. And indeed, Al-Ahram, the government-controlled newspaper of record in Egypt, in its editorial stated, second to Saudi Arabia, Iraq has the largest oil reserves on earth, roughly $1.1 trillion worth of oil, and it is that which the U.S. seeks to control. And every item of documentation that emerges from the MSNBC report corroborate that.
You know, the MSNBC report, Ralph, had a significant impact. And in Pat Buchanan has started a conservative magazine called The American Conservative. And in it, Llewellyn H. Rockwell Jr. wrote an article, A Capitalist War. And in it, he refers to the MSNBC article calling the war against Iraq a war for oil, and asks, was Lenin right? in terms of capitalism ending up being dependent upon war. And he goes and cites people who wrote before Vladimir Ilyich Lenin and his seminal work on imperialism, going back to the times of the Theodore Roosevelt and how it was important for the empire to wage war for expanding markets and how war sustained capitalism. In fact, in 1898, there was an article in the North American Review by Charles Conant, and he developed these, this was the conclusion of a series of essays that he started in 1896 called The Economic Basis of Imperialism. And in it, Conant talks about, quote, the concentration of power in order to permit prompt and efficient action, which will be an almost essential factor in the struggle for world empire. So here we have, going back to the late 1800s, the clear demarcation that there will be, that the U.S. empire, in building and constructing its empire, will be engaging in wars throughout the world. And they are explicit about where these wars will take place, and that they will look towards what is called by the U.S. investor at that time, the enlarged field for its product must be discovered, and the best source is, quote, to be found among the semi-civilized and barbarian races.
Maya, the MSNBC report is remarkable in the precise way in which the apologetics of Michael Ignatieff and Fuad Ajami and Jay Tolson are not. The report says no reputable analyst denies the windfall that will result for U.S. energy firms and the economy they power from the extended, projected American occupation of Iraq. It is not necessarily easy, but the scenario exists whereby Britain and the United States, by handling Iraq's oil resources, will carve out the ultimate strategic petroleum reserve. They quote Dr. F.J. Chalabi, the former Iraqi deputy oil minister who left in 1976 and now runs an energy consulting firm funded by the Central Intelligence Agency. And the article continues, the description about long-term American motives is bolstered by the deep ties between senior Bush administration officials, including the president and vice president, and the energy industry. The president, the vice president, and the national security advisor claim a stunning pedigree, the article continues. Bush is the former director of Harkin Energy Corporation, Cheney the chief executive officer of Halliburton Energy Services, and National Security Council Director Condoleezza Rice on the board of directors of Chevron, which named a supertanker after her. The financial disclosure forms reviewed by the Center for Public Integrity, a nonpartisan watchdog group, the report continues, reports that the top 100 officials in the Bush administration have the majority of their investments, hundreds of millions of dollars, in energy and natural resource sectors. Rice holds $225,000 worth of Chevron stock in a blind trust. Cheney's Commission on Energy Policy reflects the same involvement across the board with the oil corporations, who will benefit into trillions of dollars from the pending war and occupation.
Now, if you recall, I talked about seizing the oil of Iraq is first and foremost the Bush administration plans for the occupation. And what we have here in this seizure is the first and foremost purpose of getting rid of French and Russian influence in Iraq. Now, James Woolsey, a former CIA director, was very clear about it. He said, quote, I think the French and Russians ought to be told, not so much by the U.S., but by the Iraqi opposition to Saddam, that they are right on the edge of dealing themselves out of any hand in post-Saddam Iraq. And then he says, if the new Iraqi government should ask us for advice, and what we now know is that the new Iraqi government is going to be the United States. Woolsey says, I think I would have a very hard time finding those French and Russian telephone numbers. Now, what he's referring to is the fact that French and Russian oil companies have billions of dollars at stake, and Russia itself is owed $8 billion dating back to the 1980s because it's been the leading source of Iraq's technical know-how and the heavy equipment for constructing the oil refineries and the oil pipelines within Iraq. And today there have been contracts negotiated between French, Italian, and Russian companies, and British companies too. In France, it's Total. In Russia, it's Lukoil. In Italy, it's Eni. In Spain, it's Repsol. And in the United Kingdom, it's BHP. And these companies have already negotiated with Iraq that once UN sanctions were lifted, if ever, they would have rights to develop various oil fields such as El Hadab or the Amaro or the West Kerno or the North Ramallah or the Kermala or the Subra Luhas or the Hemrin, all these oil fields, or the Majnun oil field. But once the United States assumes occupation, all these deals are off. Now, this is made very clear in the MSNBC series. In fact, Sama Shahita, a Middle East expert at the Center for Contemporary Arab Studies in Washington, noted that, quote, Russia, China, France have the highest stakes in the Iraqi oil industry. Once Saddam is out, everything becomes null and void, and there is no legal authority to enforce those claims. And then she said, the U.S. oil industry will pose a major challenge to Saudi Arabia's position as market leader. How so? Iraq has the second largest oil reserves after Saudi Arabia, and if you count the unexplored fields, the amount of oil in Iraq probably is comparable to that in Saudi Arabia.
Well, Maya, as we were indicating, and as in many of our previous programs, the peace soup of deception, why war, these plans for the seizure of oil throughout the Middle East and Central Asia have been prepared in detail since the 1970s, and analyst William O'Brien, in his position paper on U.S. military intervention, reached these conclusions in 1978. We are on the brink of emergence from reaction against our direct military intervention. We shall undertake it, notably in the Middle East, as is increasingly urged in all American national security debates. And they described the corridor of the Persian Gulf and of the Arab East, as I've often cited, as a new El Dorado awaiting its conquistadors by 1979. Lawrence Moshe, the Pentagon analyst, was formulating the plan circulating in Washington corridors, as he said, what military people call the 100,000-man quick strike force, consisting of divisions readily deployable at any point, will be in place. But we need a real boogeyman to come in and have to be stopped before we can talk of using our quick strike force. And it will turn out that boogeyman may not be defined the same in Arabic as in English. This document published in the Middle East International on January 19, 1979. It is since that time that U.S. rulers have been preparing for the seizure of the oil of the region. And now we see this explicitly set forth in culmination in MSNBC's article on November 12th, The Saudis Between Iraq and a Hard Place. The Saudi royals fear that their hold on oil and power is now endangered. Quote, blood is thicker than water, but oil is thicker than either. That old oil industry adage, MSNBC states, aptly sums up the bonds that held together the Saudi-American relationship for three decades. And it states, The United States has little in common with the dictatorial House of Saud, proponent of fundamentalist Islam, and chief manipulator of OPEC, the world's oil cartel. And having now demonized the Saudis, as they had in, have in turn Saddam Hussein, they prepare for the seizure of oil, which looks to the day when the Saudis themselves will be removed and their oil under direct control of American military authority. That is the new imperium. And it is cold-bloodedly described by the British intelligence service reports, Stratfor, with its instructive reports on global intelligence. The United States will become mired in Iraqi occupation. This is dated December 30th, 2002, and it states, the United States has over a century of experience in occupying and reconstructing conquered countries. These occupations have proceeded smoothly only under a particular set of conditions. The United States, in its 100 years of experience in occupying and reconstructing conquered countries, has required that the quote, one, the country is utterly devastated by war prior to the occupation. Utterly devastated by war. The primary U.S. motive for pursuing the military overthrow of Saddam Hussein is to alter fundamentally the psychology of the region by demonstrating the United States' readiness to secure its interests throughout that area militarily. Washington will reinforce that perception with military reality, basing large numbers of troops in occupied Iraq and positioning itself to project its further occupation throughout the region. The United States must utterly destroy the country in question, and I'm still quoting, prior to this occupation. Despite the fact that it was founded on explicitly anti-imperialist principles, the United States repeatedly has founded itself in the position of occupying conquered countries. An incomplete list includes its own rebellious South, the Philippines, Haiti, Dominican Republic, Germany, Japan, South Korea, Bosnia, Kosovo, Cuba, Nicaragua, Chile, Grenada, Dominican Republic, and on and on.
South Korea.
There's no prettifying of what the occupation of imperialism represents, according to Stratfor.
And the softening up, you might say, of the years of the UN-imposed sanctions has also devastated Iraq and left it in a debilitated condition. Now, one factor about the UN sanctions that isn't discussed is the fact that in the Food for Oil program, a key element of it is that any money earned by Iraq cannot be used for purchasing food produced within Iraq or medicines produced in Iraq. In other words, Iraq, which has the capability to grow its own wheat for bread, which is a staple product of the Iraqi diets, Iraq must import all wheat. Consequently, this means that the Iraqi agricultural industry does not have the funds with which to develop. As well, the Iraqi pharmaceutical industry, destroyed during the bombings of the Gulf War, does not have any of the investment potential or growth potential or even survival potential because the funds to purchase and continue with the manufacture of pharmaceuticals within Iraq, which had its own pharmaceutical industry, it is debilitated because the funds that come from the Food for Oil program must be used for the purchase of these medicines abroad. In the Washington Post today, there's a story, Monday, January 6th, when we're recording this show, the buildup accelerates for the invasion of Iraq. top divisions to participate in war scenarios. And here, Ralph, just as you were saying, they talk about the massive, massive troop buildup, as high as 250,000, and that the purpose of the massive troop buildup is to let Iraq know that there can be total devastation of the country. With, as they say, the U.S. ground force would have enormous advantages in technology, firepower, and mobility, and would almost certainly begin any invasion with the benefit of near total air supremacy, according to defense officials and analysts. Now, this Washington Post article by Vernon Loeb goes into a detailed analysis of the types of tanks, the rocket systems, the Bradley fighting vehicles, how many of them there are. This is obviously a planted story, not just for the people of the United States to overwhelm us with the might and power of the U.S. armed forces and to take away from the people thinking about their loved ones being killed and the body bags coming back from Iraq, but it's also to send a message to the Iraqis that the U.S. empire means business.
Maya, I think it's useful to elaborate a little more on what the Stratfor intelligence report in Great Britain describes as the precondition for the intended and successful occupation of Iraq. When it talks about the utter destruction of the country in question prior to U.S. occupation, it adds, ideally, this destruction will include not only the physical infrastructure of the country, but its very will to resist. And it gives the examples throughout a history of U.S. intervention with German cities and their industrial base flattened in World War II, the devastation of Korea from 1950 to 1953, in which 4 million people died, the shredding, as the Stratfor describes it, of Bosnia, and the devastation of cities throughout Serbia and of all Serbian industry by the Operation Allied Force, the destruction of all working class quarters of Kosovo itself. And the article continues, during the 1898 to 1946 U.S. occupation of the Philippines, United States forces fought continual war with insurgents. The war from 1899 to 1901 resulted in over 1 million dead. It continued sporadically until 1903. U.S. military role over insurgent Moros in Mindanao continued until 1914, and the Philippines were never fully subjugated during the 1945-1949 occupation of South Korea. Opposition was so intense that the war in Korea was accompanied by massive resistance within South Korea itself. And the Stratfor report states, the 1915 to 1934 occupation of Haiti faced challenges beginning from 1918, when the Marines had to put down a 40,000-person insurgency at the cost of thousands of Haitian lives and the utter devastation of the country. For 4 years, during the 1916-1924 occupation of the Dominican Republic, U.S. forces battled insurgents known as the Gavilleros, and in Panama, the United States relied on proxy regimes to suppress the population with regular interventions, most recently with the invasion to arrest Panamanian President Manuel Noriega. New phenomenon imposed on a reluctant United States. The Stratfor report is without the rose-colored glasses of these shameless pimps for imperialism that are publishing in the New York Times and in academia and in the main organs of communication in the United States today.
On January 4th, the Sunday Morning Herald in Glasgow came out with an important article. For the U.S. military, the world is a training ground. They were referring to the new special forces training in Djibouti, in the East African nation, very impoverished nation. But what they reveal is that Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, in a report to Congress, announced that U.S. soldiers are stationed today in 110 countries around the world. The U.S. military, 1.5 million personnel on active duty, and that doesn't include all the reservists, stationed in over 110 countries. Pimping for the Imperium. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. You can reach us at 212-209-2953 or at takingaim@pacbell.net. We'll be with you next week.
Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen, Tuesdays at 5 p.m. over listener-sponsored commercial-free community radio WBAI at 99.5 FM. If you'd like to get in touch with Ralph and Maya, please call them at 707. That's out on the left coast, I believe. The left coast, 707-552-9995. Or you could leave them a message right here in New York City, 209-2953. That's 212-209-2953. They'll receive your messages and get back to you. You can also get in touch with them on the net at Taking Aim, one word, Taking Aim at PacBell.net. You are tuned to listener-sponsored, commercial-free community radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. Coming up in a moment will be